It's officially 2026, and my New Year's resolution is to prioritize high-quality pieces in my wardrobe. Thanks to Quince, I can already check that off my list. I'm already planning outfits around my new cotton Oxford shirt. It's such a classic, timeless piece that I know I'll be rewearing all year. Need more than just a wardrobe update? Quince has tons of options for the home as well. Maya has had the same dinnerware since college and has finally decided it's time for a refresh, starting with a gorgeous set of ceramic cake plates. Refresh your wardrobe with Quince. Don't wait. Go to quince.com/rehash for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. Now available in Canada, too. That's quince.com/rehash to get free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/rehash.
It's been a while.
Hello.
We say this at the beginning of every season because I feel like our hiatuses are quite long. Our hiati.
Our hentai.
Our hentai are really long.
Yeah.
Great start.
We appreciate your patience. Hopefully some of you haven't abandoned ship in our lateness.
That I would even show up to this greatness. Lateness?
You should be honored by my lateness.
You should be honored by my lateness. I
would even
episode of Girls.
Show up to this lame shit. So let's something,
go
something.
Go ahead, go nuts,
ape,
go ape
shit.
Shit.
Ape shit.
Okay, we need to stop this right now. The reason our hiatus has been so long is because Hannah and I both underwent pretty intense moves, essentially, almost immediately after we concluded last season. Hannah, do you want to update everyone about where you are? I know our patrons know where we're at, but not the general audience.
Yeah. If you guys want to know what's up with our lives and you're so curious, you got to
join
the Patreon.
Care.
Yeah, if you actually cared about us, you'd join the Patreon. Maya and I gave up our apartment at the end of September, and I decided to take advantage of my Irish passport and just sort of travel relatively aimlessly throughout Europe for the foreseeable future. So I've been gone for 2 months now. I plan on probably being gone for another 2 months at least, although where I'll be in those later months is undetermined. But I've been like pet sitting and basically like surfing from like different family members' homes. So right now I'm actually recording from Paris, and it's the only time I've like had to pay for accommodation since leaving, which is pretty insane. I'm looking out the window of my Airbnb and it is snowing outside for the first time this year, and it is unbelievably beautiful, and it's kind of so crazy because I'm sure the last time we were recording, we were complaining about a heat wave or something.
Yeah, it's chilly over there, global warming over here. Hannah's wanderlust. Yeah. I am very much sedentary. I have the privilege of getting a visa into the States, which,
woo!
For those of you who are aware of the immigration process into the United States, very lucky when you're able to get a work visa. And so I'm now living in New York, which has been a process for basically a year and a half now. So when I got my visa, I was like, damn, I have been blessed.
She was
here.
Patient as hell. Yeah, sorry.
Yeah, and now I'm here living in Trump's America. So awesome. So happy to be here still. Yeah, and so Hannah and I basically just FaceTime all the time and complain to each other about the minutia of our lives over text.
We're officially in a long-distance relationship.
And it was a huge bummer when we left that apartment. Hannah left first, and I had gotten sick, like, randomly really ill right as Hannah was leaving. So the day that she was leaving, she was supposed to stay back with me and watch, like, a movie that night. And she couldn't because I was sick. And so I had to kind of say bye to her long distance from the other side of the apartment. And it was so brutal. And then I was like alone in the apartment for the next week, sick and having to like move and get rid of all of our stuff that we had together, which felt like a divorce.
Oh my God. It was like, I feel like there was so much going on that I was just kind of like my brain and body weren't letting me emotionally process what was going on, but it was kind of insane. And yeah, we had like a really dissatisfying goodbye because poor Maya was sick like a baby, and I didn't want to.
And it's okay. I did all the emotional processing for you because I legitimately didn't stop crying for 3 days after Hannah left. Like, for some reason, it all hit me so hard, and I could not stop crying.
I hit the peak of my, like, kind of emotional processing when Maya and I watched Aquamarine the week before I left, and I, like, actually started to cry. There are a lot of really sad movies that I haven't cried at, but Aquamarine was really hitting. It really, really hit.
It replicated our friendship dynamic so well.
Yeah.
We haven't fully figured out who's JoJo and who's Claire. Or
no, we whatever have. Name is. I'm Emma Roberts and you're JoJo, but you don't want to be JoJo.
No, but just only in this dynamic, I've always been Emma Roberts. And I remember crying when she gets thrown in the pool as a kid because I felt so connected to her as a child. But I feel like in our dynamic, for some reason, I'm JoJo. But like in all my other friend dynamics, I feel like I'm Emma Roberts. It's weird.
But believe, like, I definitely have friendships where I'm JoJo. And maybe I have some friendships where I'm Aquamarine.
Maybe we're both Aquamarine to each other.
Wow. You know what we are to each other? We're those starfish that she wears on her ear, because we're always complimenting each other and giving each other good, loving support.
So true, queen.
Okay, enough about us.
I'm Maya.
And I'm Hannah.
And this is Rehash, a podcast about the internet phenomena that strike a nerve in our culture, only to be quickly forgotten, but we think are due for a revisiting. This season is about internet subcultures. The stories of how they arrived, thrived, and sometimes died. If you like our show and you want to hear more from us, you can support us on Patreon at patreon.com/rehashpodcast, where we have bonus episodes, weekly mini episodes, and early access to our regular programming. If you don't want to join the Patreon, feel free to rate and review us on Spotify and Apple Podcasts, because
that helps a lot.
This is the first episode of the season, and before we get into the episode, I just want to quickly explain what we mean by internet subcultures. So Dick Hebdige is this scholar who, back in 1979, wrote this seminal book in cultural studies called Subculture, The Meaning of Style, which is basically all about Britain's youth subcultures at the time, like teddy boys and punks, whatnot. And essentially, he defines subculture as a group with distinctive, self-contained rituals and aesthetic signifiers, like certain types of clothing or hairstyles, who are characterized by their opposition to dominant society, like normie culture, essentially, who are sometimes even, in his words, quote, dismissed, denounced, and canonized, treated at different times as threats to public order and as harmless buffoons. Hebdige's book is, like, very specific to these particular youth subcultures, but I think its idea of a distinctive aesthetic culture as being not a part of the dominant society is pretty useful here. Many of the subcultures that we'll be looking at this season also have their own distinctive set of, like, rituals to adhere by and regalia that you have to wear in order to gain membership to that subculture. Many of them also have been maligned at one point or another by the dominant culture. But what sets them apart from the subcultures in Hebdige's book is that the internet plays a key role in how these subcultures originated. So this episode is about furries, perhaps one of the most maligned subcultures on the internet. But I'm here to say that maybe we were too quick to judge. To start, Hannah, what is your understanding of what a furry is?
Furries are people who dress up like animals or like non-human creatures, I suppose. I thought it was like a kink thing, or at least I think a lot of people talk about it in that regards. A friend of ours used to work at a movie theater, and he told a story about this one time when Zootopia was in theaters during a matinee. A group of furries came, I think, like on opening day, and I always thought that was really funny. But other than that, like, I haven't encountered furries in the wild. I've mostly just heard about them online.
Okay, yeah. I also haven't really encountered furries. There are a few kind of misconceptions that you said there that I'm going to try and kind of debunk in this episode, or at least kind of like challenge. So, like, for example, many people think furries are, like, a sexually deviant group of people who are attracted to animals, like, that it's a kink. A lot of people also think that furries are people who genuinely believe themselves to be animals. Neither of these assumptions is fully true. Like, both are pretty wide generalizations. Furries, like everybody, have nuance. So essentially, a furry is a person with an above-average interest in anthropomorphic characters who aligns themselves with the furry fandom. The fandom doesn't have strict rules for what constitutes its membership. Like, many people think that all furries wear the full-body suits, which are called fursuits, but this isn't actually true. Being a furry can range anywhere from being, like, a person who draws and consumes a lot of furry-related art. You might be interested in that, Hannah. I feel like an aunt who's like, Hannah, you like art, right?
Okay, I'm sorry. I just really need to specify for the listeners that I might be interested in it because I like art. Because the way you put that made it seem like, well, Hannah, of course you would like that.
I said you might be, Hannah.
I know.
So, like, typically a lot of furry art is like kind of cartoonish or anime style art of like furry creatures. Being a furry can be, like, talking in furry chat rooms, to also going to furry conventions in person, to, like, wearing the full-on fursuit, to even being a furry pundit, which there are some of those. There are famous furries. But what ties the majority of these people together is their identification with what they call a fursona. So it's a play on the word persona, if you didn't get that.
My favorite Bergman film.
Same. This is essentially an alter ego of sorts that's modeled after an anthropomorphic character based off of a variety of real-life animals or, like, hybrids of animals. So the most common fursonas come in the forms of dragons or reptilian-type creatures. There will be, like, canines, like wolves or foxes or dogs. There'll be, like, felines, like cats, lions, or tigers. There's a variety of birds, like falcons or griffins. Or you'll get kind of combinations of these. So there's, like, a lot of fulfs, which is a fox and a wolf. Or there's a cabbit, like a cat and a rabbit. A big portion of the research for this episode was drawn from a book by a prolific furry named Joe Strike. The book is called Furry Nation: The True Story of America's Most Misunderstood Subculture. The writing in the book is pretty casual and at times kind of, like, overwritten, but generally Joe comes across very sweet and earnest, and he begins the book by stating outright that being a furry is not about actual animals, but rather the idea of them, quote, what they represent in our minds, not their reality. I think this is a good thing to keep in mind for the rest of the episode. A study from 2021 found that the furry fandom is majority under the age of 25, nearly 75% of the participants interviewed, and another study also found that they're majority male in gender, which is really interesting. Although the fandom is also extremely neurologically and sexually diverse, there are quite a lot of furries who are on the spectrum, and it's very LGBTQ friendly. I'm also not entirely sure about the male statistic. Like, that was just one study of a particular group of people, so it's hard to tell. Overwhelmingly, the research I consumed characterizes furries as an inclusive and kind-hearted group. There's a really great American Hysteria episode about furries, and the guest that they interview on it talks about going to this furry convention back in the day and experiencing almost, like, a religious level of happiness, even though he himself wasn't a furry, just by virtue of, like, how warm and welcoming the atmosphere was and, like, the excitement from people there. Any furry video that you watch online where people, like, infiltrate furry conventions and interview furries, the interviewer often comes away with this idea that they're really, like, lovely and misunderstood people. I'd also say another thing I took away from the research is that furries don't really get credit enough for their creativity. Like, a lot of these people are coming up with really unique characters, all of which have their own personality types. They'll have, like, their own regalia and, like, coloring, like, colorways and, like, facial expressions and backgrounds. Like, they'll write a whole background for their character. Some people buy their fursuits from fursuit manufacturers, which are, like, crazy expensive. They can range from $2,000 to $15,000. But many of them also make their own, which is genuinely insane. Like, they make them at home. For those of you who aren't familiar, like, these are, like, head-to-toe suits with their own heads and tails, and, like, a lot of them have their own accessories. Some of them have earrings. Others wear, like, clothes. Some of them have wings. There's this Vice article that interviews this one girl who talks about how she makes her suit by duct taping her body and then making a duct tape dummy out of that and then sewing a body pattern onto the dummy and, like, adding tape and fur and whatnot. And her suit, she says, has, like, a movable tail, which is crazy, like, making that yourself. Another person they interview has one suit that requires them to, like, walk on all fours with stilts, which is genuinely really cool.
That's really awesome. It kind of reminds me a bit of and I don't know if this, I don't know, will I get in trouble for this comparison, but it reminds me a bit of like drag when you think about like the investments people make in like wigs. Wigs are expensive, but then also just like the kind of creativity of like, I love hearing that like people have made and designed their own like costumes, especially when people create these characters and like are really inspired by things. I love that kind of stuff. I love costume.
Yeah, and I think if we get away from like conflating gender sexuality into, you know, drag with furries, yeah, in that regard, like it is a lot like drag in that way, like creating this alter ego, creating this persona that allows you to kind of experiment with your identity. So yeah, people are drawn to furry culture for a variety of reasons. Some people cite that like being bullied in school or having difficult home lives caused them to kind of retreat into themselves, and creating, you know, their own customized character was kind of like an escape from harsher realities. So more like it was a chosen family for them. Some people talk about how they came to it through a love for drawing, and like drawing special characters kind of was a way of allowing them to explore their own identity and like a tool for self-expression. And a lot of them correlated with actually discovering their own sexual identity, like within the LGBTQ community. Some people talk about how it was a love for costuming, like you love, and cosplay. They see furrydom more as a form of play. Others talk about how it's an extension of their love for cartoons or anime, so a bit more of like a fandom element to it. It can also be a combination of all those things. So a lot of people tend to conflate furries with bronies. But can you think of one fundamental difference between them?
Bronies are adult men that are really into My Little Pony, which I guess if we're thinking in lines of like adults who are interested in animal cartoons, maybe that's the closest thing they have in common. But I guess maybe they just kind of came into the public consciousness around the same time. And I guess both of them kind of became like punching bags online or something. But I would say, yeah, like a fundamental difference is that bronies just really like a TV show and furries seem to have their own kind of lifestyle.
Yeah, totally. I think I would agree that they both came into public consciousness. Like, I think I would say around the mid to late 2010s, like although furries have been around longer, I think that a lot of different media appearances or like I feel like video sharing platforms kind of brought them to even wider attention, and same with bronies. But exactly, the biggest difference between them is tied to this pre-existing IP, which is the My Little Pony franchise. So I'd argue that bronies are kind of leaning a little bit more towards fandom than subculture, although there's obviously overlap between those things. Furries, on the other hand, are like completely self-contained. Like they're clearly inspired by different cartoons. But what I think is so cool about it is that fursonas are entirely self-constructed and have zero limitations on like what they can be. Whereas bronies, there's actually a lot of limitations in the broy fandom. Like there's a lot of pretty strict rules for membership. Jenny Nicholson has this really great video about like the bajillion issues with bronydom, which I suggest you check out. It's so interesting. But one of the major problems is that it's basically this, yeah, large group of grown men hijacking a cartoon property that was specifically designed for children, and then kind of pushing children and women out of that fandom while also sexualizing it.
So I was always, my thing with bronies, I never knew if it was sexual. So is it?
So similar with furrydom, and I'll get into this, there is a sexual element to bronydom. But like the weirder part is that it is like this specifically children's IP. But like there are, you know, My Little Pony boyfriend pillows, and like the fandom makes their own kind of like sexual paraphernalia for it. And even just like the way that they kind of draw like the My Little Ponies, like I think the reanimation of My Little Pony from these chubby ponies to these like snatched skinny ponies with side bangs, it's already weird from the show itself.
The Kylie Jennerification of My Little Pony, like beauty standards weird. Not even girl horses can escape harsher beauty standards. Like we're all, the 21st century is so perverse.
Fuck, she's on fire right now.
Like yeah, they don't need to be hot. Yeah,
let ponies be fat. But so
they don't need BBLs.
It's obvious that the brony fandom also took this and like ran with it. But it's harder to run into that issue with furries when there's no original property to speak of. No one is a fan of like any one thing. Like they're all kind of individuals forming this community around similar innate interests. And because of this, while there are prominent furries in the community, it's also non-hierarchical, which I think is really interesting. There was this tweet going around a few years ago that was basically like, quote tweet me a thing that everyone in your field of work knows and nobody talks about because it would lead to chaos. Like, that was the original tweet. And one of the quote tweets that responded to it went, like, pretty viral. It said, "Telecommunications as a whole, which also encompasses the internet, is in a constant state of failure and just-in-time fixes. And functionally, all modern communication would collapse if about 50 people, most of which are furries, decided to turn their pager off for a day." Basically, the whole thing being that furries comprise a shockingly large section of the IT sector. This is, like, a pretty popular sentiment on the internet, that all technology would shut down if the furries, like, disappeared or something. What do you think of this? Like, why do you think furries are so involved in the tech industry?
It sounds like furries, probably, like, a lot of their history is connected to the internet, and, like, it seems like they've formed on the internet. And I feel like, similar to how some of the first people who were using internet chat boards were, like, LARPers and, you know, people playing Dungeons and Dragons, like, I think that there is, like, a lot of overlap of people who like fantasy and who like world building and who kind of like that form of escapism with being internet enthusiasts. So it makes a lot of sense to me.
Yes, Hannah, she's cooking today. Ugh, okay. Your brain, your mind.
Wow, thank you.
So a little bit of, like, history. There isn't a very clear point of origin for furries, but the consensus seems to be that they started to pop up in the 80s, mainly around people who, you know, felt a special affinity for anthropomorphic cartoons. Joe Strike is one of them. And he says that people would be harboring these interests and then kind of begin meeting other people with the same interests at, like, sci-fi and comic book conventions or, like, clubs dedicated to animated films. But it wasn't really until the 90s, with the advent of the World Wide Web, that furrydom would really start to take off as a subculture. So to answer the question about furries being so dominant in IT, that person who wrote that quote tweet went on to say, "Furries have always run the internet since bulletin board days. Furries had a dedicated ISP, so internet service provider, before the White House got internet service. A lot of furries turned their hobby in tech into day jobs in the early days of the field, then trained their friends to get jobs at the places they worked, who were also furries, and that's continued for 30 years now across the globe."
Okay, you want to know what's crazy is, we'll talk about this later this season, but actually, like, the first people who were online other than, like, the government were deadheads and then were, like, fantasy and role-playing nerds, like furries. And it is so funny because that's very similar to the history of deadheads.
Yeah, geek culture has really, like, shaped the internet.
Well, geek and stoner culture, apparently.
Geek and stoner culture, yeah, which, yeah, freaks and geeks
overlap sometimes, yeah. Oh my god!
I've had trouble, obviously, confirming if it's true that furries run all of our technology, but the literature does tell me that, yes, furries were very much part of the early internet, like you were saying. Wild guess, Hannah, where do you think furries first started to convene?
Moo.
Yes, wait, Moo and Mud.
Moos and Muds!
Very good.
Aw.
If you guys don't know, Hannah did an episode on chat rooms that actually I think is a really good companion piece to this episode and to probably a lot of the episodes in this season, but she did a great job and she talks a lot about these Moo and Mud chat rooms that are basically completely text-based. Yeah. They're kind of like the earliest version of chat rooms on the internet.
They began as ways to play Dungeons and Dragons and role-playing games online. So, like, again, like, they were built by fantasy nerds, so.
Exactly. So the ISP, or internet service provider, that the person on Twitter was talking about, the one that predated the White House, it's called Tiger Den Internet Services. It was established in 1994 by a retired Air Force major, like, full-grown man who was in the Army, who goes by the name Tiger Wolf. And essentially, Tiger Den hosts a number of, like, different, they're called Muck chat rooms, so similar to Moo and Mud. So there's, like, Tiger Muck, Raccoon Muck, and then the Pack Muck. Before that, even, furries were congregating on different electronic boards and Usenet platforms in the very early 90s. Joe Strike talks about one called Furry Muck, which originated in 1990, and he says that's where a lot of early furries were introduced to the fandom. He says a plain old chat room was kind of preferable for a lot of people in the furry fandom to computer games or games like Dungeons and Dragons that were so popular on there, because the regular chat rooms kind of allowed you to experiment and role play with your fursona without the added game element. The whole idea being that it's just kind of like real life online.
Oh my god, I can't remember the name of the moo that we talked about in the chat room episode, but that was like on there. People would be the kind of the moo that that there was the crazy thing with the clown that happened.
The evil clown. You guys need to listen to this episode.
Go listen to the episode. I can't believe I forgot the name of it. But people on there, like in writing about it, it's like people, yeah, would take on like basically otherworldly kind of characters. Like you were kind of limitless in that sense. So it was similarly like to what you're describing.
Exactly. And then, which is something we also talk about in the chat rooms episode, Second Life came out in 2003. Do you want to just give a brief explainer of what Second Life is?
Yeah, well, it's sort of where you are an avatar and you like live in this world and you can build houses and like go to people's houses and stuff.
It's kind of like interactive Sims a little bit, but even more hyper realistic. Yeah.
Yeah, I got kicked out of it for some. I tried to play it for the episode and they kicked my avatar out of somewhere. I could not understand how to play it to save my life.
You're just doing it so wrong. They were like, you need to leave.
No, like, I don't know what happened, but yeah, I couldn't build the internet personally.
The furries would never kick you out of there. So Second Life came out in 2003, and this is where furrydom completely blew up, because a big part of the furry community is like the visual aspect, right? Like drawing up your character, embodying your fursona. And since the Muds and Moods were text-based only, Second Life, you know, introduced that visual element. Joe Strike actually takes you on this experience that he has in Second Life. Like he downloads Second Life and he's like, let's walk around. And he meets up with another furry who's already a user who offers to show him around. And I just want to read you this passage just to get a sense of the book. It's a bit overwhelming at first, but Big Z's avatar is so cool looking that it definitely calms the nerves. He's a heavily accessorized anthro wolf dressed in black slacks and a short sleeved shirt. He's wearing a set of headphones, has a panda on his shoulder, a cookie in his mouth, and he carries two glow sticks that leave a trail of colorful flashes of light as he walks. It's easy to find him if he gets out of sight, which he often does while I try to keep up with him. It's just really focused on the kind of outward expression of this guy's fursona, like even just as saying like it calms his nerves. It's just, there's something about like the full realization of the fursona that really, I think, is enticing to people in this fandom. But anyways, going back to our conversation in the chat rooms episode, it's just really interesting to think about the way that the internet is able to like bridge these very niche or marginalized groups together. Do you see kind of the parallels there?
Yeah, of course. I think what I found researching the chat rooms is that a lot of people felt like a sort of freedom in the anonymity of the internet. I mean, early internet, at least. And in the sort of the ability to represent yourself using an avatar safely in these spheres in a way that you couldn't necessarily do in your public life, I think has a lot of appeal for people of marginalized identities, especially in the 90s and like early 2000s. And I think there's also just, you know, physical limitations that come with like how you can express yourself as a person unless you build an anthropomorphic suit. Like you're not really going to be able to physically embody and articulate how you're feeling or how you see yourself. So it makes sense. Like the internet lets you do that. It's one of the more magical properties of it, I think.
Yeah, totally. Like the whole idea of being marginalized is being restricted by your identity, being restricted by things that society doesn't give you access to or like intentionally pushes out or whatever limits.
And so I think
what drives so many people, you know, like on the spectrum or in LGBTQ communities or like people from different races, like to furrydom is, yeah, this idea of anonymity and being able to kind of, the liberation of it, like the freedom of it, essentially.
Yeah, well, transcending your human form, right? That's what the internet lets you do.
And then also finding community within that. So it's like, you know, you have the liberation, but you also get to kind of like socially convene with people. And I think what's so special about furrydom is that it's so unrestrictive. Like membership is so unrestrictive compared to like a lot of the other subcultures that we'll be talking about this season. And I just think like the desire to find people like you or to feel like a part of something kind of necessitates this knowledge of technology. The two things kind of come hand in hand. So a lot of furries, you know, became fluent on the internet simply by virtue of like the fact that they needed the internet. They felt that they needed the internet. And so it's kind of this confluence of like being already good at like understanding technology, but then also needing technology to be able to like fully be yourself makes you really good at technology. And so maybe that's how so many of them ended up in IT. Who knows? So I've talked a lot about how furries convene on the internet, but like I said, they also meet up in person at furry conventions. And these public appearances are what really brought them to mainstream attention, mostly in a negative way. Our general understanding of furries typically, you know, is a bunch of people wearing full body fursuits, getting together at these events and like doing weird kinky shit. This has been very much propelled by some unflattering depictions in popular media. So, for example, in 2003, there was a CSI episode called Fur and Loathing, which starts off with them investigating the murder of a guy who is a raccoon furry. And a lot of what characterizes the episode is like basically the leads kind of disparaging this man for his interests while they look into his death, like just not taking his death very seriously. And the episode depicts the conventions as these like kind of eyes wide shut type Kabbalah orgies. Like one of the characters is this gay lawyer guy played by Willie Garson. May he rest in peace, my king, whose persona is called Sexy Kitty. He's like, meow.
Wait, but in this episode, are they wearing like the big suits, like the mascot costumes?
Yeah.
So it's, I'm sorry, now I'm just picturing Eyes Wide Shut, but when Tom Cruise enters that like weird ceremony he's not supposed to see, I'm seeing everybody in like a mascot.
They're wearing like
costume.
The full fursuits. Yeah, it's so, so ridiculous. And it's actually funny because I watched a video by this furry on YouTube who's basically like debunking, like doing a commentary on the entire episode. And like first shot, they take off the guy's head. And the furry is like, anybody in furrydom knows that that's not an actual furry head. That is a mascot head because furry heads have padding.
It's like, see, and I love someone with an attention for detail.
And furries have that. So yeah, this episode kind of really helped to kick off this idea of like furrydom being like a kink. This was made even worse in 2009 when Tyra Banks, who as we all know is known for her well-researched and very nuanced approaches to fringe cultures.
Did you watch
the Tyra show growing up?
That's a rhetorical question, right? I was raised by the Tyra show. I used to be so excited when I had to stay homesick from school because it meant I could watch the Tyra show when it was on in the middle of the day. I don't remember, but I'm sure that I learned about furries through the Tyra show, as I learned about a lot of social issues and a lot of marginalized communities. And I'm sure that it gave me a very warped understanding of them. I learned what trans people were because of America's Next Top Model. I learned what Islamophobia was from the Tyra show.
The entire show is a double-edged sword. It's like it gave communities exposure, but maybe like the wrong exposure.
Earlier you mentioned an episode from American Hysteria in your research, and there's a really, really great one on these sort of daytime talk shows as these almost functioning as freak shows, but then also platforming marginalized groups before anybody else would. So it was sort of this weird space that they occupied, like when the Club Kids would go on Geraldo or something in the 90s. Yeah. But anyways, just sidebar, but if people are interested, they should listen.
And it was kind of really dependent on how the host would hijack the conversation, because like sometimes they were able to kind of get their voice out there. Sasha Gray, for example, went on the Tyra show and she was able to articulate herself so well, but Tyra was still coming at her with these like fucking insulting questions. Like Tyra's very close-minded and kind of a dick, and so a lot of the time when she's interviewing people, it's just like she comes at them with these ridiculous questions. I don't even feel bad saying that. Tyra Banks is a terrible lady, but
no, Tyra Banks is a really
great TV.
She's a really bad person who has unfortunately shaped a lot of my life because I
like,
watched
gave her
so
that
much
power?
Top Model. I don't know. I used to idolize Tyra Banks. That's for
of course,
another day.
We all did.
Yeah.
Well, she also has this like god complex, so it's like you have to be like Tyra. Yeah. Anyways, but she, yeah, like me, 11, tuning in to be like, oh, I wonder what the teenage prostitutes are saying on Tyra Banks.
Yeah, like, I can't wait to hear about these two 15-year-olds trying to have a baby.
that was all of MTV at that point.
Well, yes.
Yeah. So basically, like, she has this episode where she has these like three beds set up, and basically I think it's like the sexual deviant episode. Like she's like, this couple has sex with many people, or like this couple does this. And then so there's three beds, and she introduces this one couple by saying, one of these couples has sex in animal costumes. This is how it went.
Is it like costumes like at the amusement park? Yeah, it is. Oh my gosh.
It is quite similar. Yes.
That would be mascot. Like you go to a football game.
We like to go out to different places and wear it. There are events that you go to with other furries, and they have dances in their costumes.
Okay, when you go to Disneyland, do you guys get turned on? No? You're not looking at Mickey Mouse going, hi, going, ooh, yeah. No?
No.
Okay,
no.
Do you have sex when you have the costume on?
Yes.
Isn't there a costume down there too, though?
There are strategically placed holes. Yes.
Strategically placed holes. Okay. Now, I know people would say that this is kind of like animal sex, like bestiality.
It is not. Not in any way.
Yeah.
I would never actually have sex with an animal.
This caused a lot of discord in the furry community because, like any community, people diverge in interests and, like, there are subsects of it. There's, like, an alt-right subsect of furries called the Furry Raiders, who identify as alt-fur. That's their signifier. Some of whom also wear what looks like a swastika in the form of a paw on their uniforms. And when anyone's like, oh, that's a swastika, you can't bring that in here, they're like, actually, it's a paw.
Do you think there are any furries at the insurrection?
Oh, potentially, for sure. Yeah.
Yeah.
They're alt-right furries.
That's crazy.
These people are not generally accepted by the larger furry community. And yes, there are definitely furries who incorporate a sex element into it, like the two people on Tyra. These two people, like, they're kind of, like, well-known in the community now. And a lot of people were mad at them for talking about sex, but, like, it is kind of an aspect of furry culture. There's also, like, a lot of furry porn online. Like, one of my friends works as a content moderator and said that, like, they get a lot of this kind of stuff coming at them, furry-related porn. But again, a lot of furries don't accept that as a defining feature of the community. Although, I would argue that the sex part isn't necessarily bestiality or like a kink for animals in the way that I think a lot of people characterize it. I don't know. What do you think of the sex element?
Furries are anthropomorphic. And I think included in that is the fact that like their bodies still somewhat resemble human bodies. And I don't think their minds are supposed to like be like, to me it doesn't come across as the same as being attracted to animals, like their own categorization. And I think it's sort of like how people were attracted to the fox from Robin Hood as kids doesn't mean that they are attracted to foxes, but you know, that was a particularly hot fox.
That's also sexy.
And he's a fox person, you know, he's not a real fox.
Yeah.
And so I don't know. I think that like obviously people are going to jump to that because it's salacious and they don't understand furries, so it's like easier to put that down. Plus, you know, generally the general population isn't open to people who like to express themselves in different ways and will find a way to frame it as sexually deviant. So, totally. Yeah, it tracks.
Exactly. And I just think that like it's, yeah, again, it's more about embodying like, as Joe Strike says, embodying a different identity or an inner identity than it is about like actual animals. So I see it more as like adults having this interest like in being anthropomorphic and then incorporating that interest into their sex lives. Like it's just, if fursona is meant to be like a facet of who they are, then it kind of makes sense that it would bleed into other areas of their lives. I don't know. I'm just trying to be open-minded. Like I think that there's enough disdain on the internet about this. I don't really want to contribute to it.
What's wrong with two consenting people dressed as animals having sex with each other? Like, there aren't any.
Well, yeah.
Yeah.
How different is it than, like, a girl wearing, like, cat ears during, like, some sort of sex play? Like, I don't know. I don't think it's, like, that different.
I feel like, obviously, we're not kink shaming, and I'm not trying to be close-minded about kinks, but there are kinks I've heard about that I would be much quicker to judge than two people, yeah, wearing, like, little fursuits. Adults wear diapers for sex, you know? I don't know.
Exactly. If it was actually a kink, too. I think what really brought to light how disdained the subculture is when there was a terrorist attack on a furry convention in Illinois called Midwest Fur Fest back in 2014, Basically, someone intentionally leaked chlorine gas into the building, which, like, keep in mind, the use of chlorine gas by a military force is considered a war crime. It basically, like, burns your lungs from the inside out. It's extremely painful and lethal.
Oh, God.
Yeah, it's fucked. So a bunch of people had to be rushed in ambulances. I think they caught it pretty early. But police essentially did nothing about it. Like, nothing at all. There's this whole investigative podcast series about this by Nikki Wolf, who's the guest on that American Hysteria episode. This podcast is also called Fur and Loathing. So you should go listen to that. It's really interesting. But when it was reported on the Morning Joe show on MSNBC, Mika Brzezinski basically broke down laughing during her reporting of it and, like, ran out of the room.
The Chicago Tribune, 19 people were hospitalized at a furry convention in Illinois after what's being called an intentional leak of chlorine gas.
What's a furry convention?
Did I get that wrong?
What leaked there? Oh, gosh.
Okay. Officials were called when a strong odor of chlorine spread.
I think they had to evacuate the building and everything. Sent the hotel guests along with convention attendees into the cold night, many still dressed in their furry costumes.
We just told Mika what the convention was about. She's...
Costumes kept everybody warm was the good news. The hotel was
contaminated. Hey!
Guests came back
come
inside
back.
At 4 a.m. Police still...
Come back!
The matter is a criminal investigation.
Could you check on Mika, see if she's okay? She's over there somewhere.
Mika has left the building.
All right.
She just learned something. She learned something important about this world.
She just learned something that we all wish we didn't know.
And it's considered this really funny, unscripted news segment, but when you really break it down, it's so shameful and, like, really bad journalism. Like, really should be embarrassing.
Did anyone die?
No. People were injured, though. And, like, they still don't know who did it, but it was a terror attack on thousands of people. People could have died.
Do they think it was targeted?
It's hard to know, and, like, they talk about this in the series, but whether or not it was coming from outside as, like, a hate attack, or whether or not it was coming from within, like, because of this, like, whole alt-fur movement, like, they don't know if it was internal or external. They don't know because there was no investigation.
How?
It was basically just mocked because of, like, who the attack was on. Similar to that Fur and Loathing episode of CSI, right? Someone dies and then the characters are like, yeah, but he's a furry. You know what I mean? Like, it's this kind of thing, this mockery. And yeah. Joe ends the show by being like, Mika just learned something that we wish we didn't know. And it's like, you're a fucking journalist. Like, you've definitely seen far worse than this. Like, you don't need to put on such a spectacle, you know?
Again, it's like, I just feel like there are weirder things out there than people wanting to dress up as animals. Like, I just really don't think that, like, it's that crazy, I guess. Or, like, maybe no. I'm just used, like, I've heard of furries before, so it's not, like, they're not, like, a shockingly new concept to me. But, like, as activity-wise, it just sounds like people kind of being cute.
Well, it's not so different from, like, LARPing, you know, people going to the forest, doing a Renaissance fair. Like, I don't know, I don't think it's that different. Of course, it's, like, more outwardly strange to us, but it's, like, I don't know. To me, pretty innocuous in many ways. But again, you know, yeah, furries are just treated quite badly by the general population. And sometimes I'll be on TikTok and there'll be this, like, cute little, like, teenage furry dancing in their room. And, like, their video clearly, like, accidentally went viral. And the comments are always so cruel. Like, I've seen so many videos like this and the comments are like, kill yourself, you know. I remember, like, a few years ago, there was this furry who, like, kids on TikTok were speculating had killed themselves because of the hate. But then it was, like, unclear what happened. But it's just, like, they get a lot of flack on the internet. They're subject to a lot of cruelty.
Do you think a lot of that is because of the misconception that what they're doing is kink? So if someone sees someone dressed as a furry on an app like TikTok that we, you know, treat as like an app for children, even though like all adults are on it, but if someone sees that, like, would people jump to the conclusion that they're trying to post kink related content?
Of course there's the kink aspect. I think that, and like, maybe I'll pose this question now, but I think, like, a lot of it is just loving to participate in cringe culture, right? I think a lot of furries are seen as extensions of, like, cat girls from school who became the subject of a lot of mockery on TikTok, like, a few years ago. You know, the girls that would hiss at you. I'm sure many of them are furries, but it's, like, you know, it's also just, like, kind of, like, standard bullying as well.
You know, when I was a child, for a brief period of time, I thought I was half cat because my cat licked my pacifier, and then, like, I didn't know that I found out after I put the pacifier in my mouth, or maybe it was my brother's pacifier and I just really liked pacifiers. I don't know. But anyways, I got cat germs in me and I thought that that made me half cat. So I did spend about a year of my life when I was like 6 or 7 telling people I was half cat. So does that make me a cat girl?
Maybe. Were you hissing at kids in the hallway?
I'm sure I like licked my paw or something, like my hand was a paw. Yeah. But I would feel like I'm young enough to get away with it. I never wore cat ears.
I don't know. I thought I was a ghost hunter. I would like hunt and ghosts. And you were.
And I Who said you was. Weren't? Why not?
I would have like hysterical attacks in class being like, oh, there's a ghost. And like the teacher would have to come intervene.
Oh my God. But you could have gone on the Tyra show if you kept it up.
I probably should have been bullied. But I just wonder what it is about the internet that makes us feel disgust in such a way. Like, what makes us feel so inclined to cringe at things, you know? I think about it. One of the articles I was reading for this described furries as representing a sort of neo-sincerity. Like, the fandom is so earnest in their love for anthropomorphism and just in the general hobbies that surround furrydom. And I just think, unfortunately, that kind of comes at odds with the current, like, irony-poisoned time that we're in.
In my head, I'm like, when I think about things I cringe over, it's things that are, hate to use this word, but, like, chuggy, or things that feel almost lame or passé. But there's almost, like, something so subcultural and so kind of different to furries that it's almost, like, it feels funny to even cringe at that because they're so out of the norm.
It's so lame to, like, punch down. Like, it just feels like it's punching down. And I just think that's lame.
It is kind of like if you made fun of the kid who, like, sat and drew dragons in class. It's like, why?
That's exactly what it is. Yeah, it's just bullying. A lot of it is just bullying. We'll get to the sexual aspect in a sec. But yeah, I think it's just so hard for us to fathom, like, a group of adults wrapping themselves around something so openly and, like, happily. Something that we associate with childhood. So I think it's simultaneously, like, this uncanniness of, like, a group of adults being into something that we thought we left behind. And then also this underlying disgust of, like, the sincerity of it all. Like, we think that they should have shame and they just don't. Can't beat the shame into them. I also think an element of it is, like, a fear of mascots and, like, people being masked. I think that really freaks people out. Thanks, John Wayne Gacy.
That was face paint.
Yeah, but, like, I think the idea of, like, clowns, like, not really, you know what I mean, not really fully knowing the identity of someone freaks people out, especially if it's conflated with, like, childhood. But again, this is just me speculating about why people might have this knee-jerk response to them. Do you think the backlash to furries could qualify as a moral panic?
I think it depends. I think if maybe they tried to enter the mainstream more, I think that that could result in moral panic. I mean, and again, I'm not trying to make, like, a one-for-one comparison with drag queens. There's obviously big differences between them and, like, their histories are so different. But if you just think about the way in America drag queens interacting with children is being demonized by the right, because even though the art of drag is not inherently sexual, obviously people sometimes in their acts incorporate elements of sexuality, but drag on its own is not an inherently sexual performance. The right is, of course, freaking out about, you know, a drag queen reading a storybook to, like, a group of children and claiming that there is, like, some kind of perverse sexual element to that. And I can just see that if somehow furries ever made it to a mainstream enough place where they were interacting with children, I could see a very fierce backlash because, again, they are interpreted as being sexual, even if that's not always the case.
Some of these people are, like, parents who are like, oh, these adults are influencing my child, you know, to be like this. And I think that's, like, kind of part of the fear of, like, no one wants their child to be deviant. And, like, obviously with drag queens, it comes from, like, straight up homophobia and, like, transphobia.
Well, it's also just, like, choosing to live outside of, like, assigned roles, which I think furries are doing in their own way. It might not always pertain to gender, but it's even just, like, in how we're supposed to present ourselves and all of that.
Yeah, exactly. Like your child is just deviating from the norm in some way, which, of course, is different from a political identity, like sexual or gender identity, but still. I don't think it's, like, a full-blown moral panic, I agree. But I do think, yeah, it gets absorbed into this current wave of, like, think of the children, which is honestly one of my least favorite waves that we've ever been in. But, like, you know, a lot of people are hearing about these secretly, like, you know, kinky children's TV shows on YouTube and, like, kids being preyed upon on the internet and, like, this whole post-euphoria freak out of, like, sexualizing teens. And I think furries kind of get tied into those fears. One of the studies that I was reading talks about how there is a lot of concern for underage furries, like, interacting with adult furries in the fandom, especially because there is a lot of circulation of furry porn and erotica within these spaces, mm-hmm. which I do think is a valid concern. I also think because of the masking and the anonymity of it, there could be room for, like, inappropriate interactions. But again, like, a lot of furries maintain that the community, for the most part, is quite PG. There are a lot of, like, underage furries there. So now I want to move on to... I don't want to call it a subsect of furrydom because there is a lot of debate about this, but essentially there's a group of people who call themselves otherkin, and their whole thing is that they identify as animals. Have you heard of them?
I've heard of them in the way where people will refer to, like, old elements of, like, Tumblr in its heyday, and they'll bring up furrykin along with other things, but I don't know too much about them beyond, like, what you just said.
We actually had quite a few requests to do, like, a full dedicated episode to otherkin, but I thought that it would actually tie in well here thematically. It's basically people feeling that they identify as animals either neurologically, like they feel that inside they're a certain type of animal species, or they feel like a spiritual tie to an animal species. And there's this debate in the furry community about this because a lot of furries separate themselves from otherkin and say that, like, being a furry has nothing to do with actually being an animal. And I think that's, like, fueled a lot by, like, these negative perceptions of furrydom. But Joe Strike does have, like, a whole chapter on otherkin in his book and talks about how a lot of otherkin are actually members of the furry community because it's this a way for them to express this identity. So the two aren't the same, but they overlap sometimes. There are actually two different groups of people with similar ideologies. So one is called Therians and... or Therians, I actually don't know. And they think that they're an animal born into a human body. So one person Joe Strike interviews says that, like, for their whole life, they had these really intense, vivid dreams where in the dream, they're a wolf. And they say they have, like, a lot of amplified wolf senses, maybe similar to how you felt as a kid being a cat. But these are like grown people. It sounds kind of like Arya Stark style wolf dreams, essentially. Another guy talks about how he's, like, really awkward on the outside and has trouble relating to other humans, but feels a sense of, like, oneness with nature, and he feels inside that he's a deer. Otherkin are similar to Therians or Therians, except they identify with mystical creatures, so, like, dragons or griffins, for example. The term otherkin is said to have first been used in this mailing list called Elfkin Digest back in 1990, and these groups also came up similar in tandem with furries on the early days of the internet in, like, Usenet groups like alt.horror or werewolves, where people would bond over their connections to mystical beings. There's been a lot of pushback from the LGBTQ community regarding otherkin and Therians because I think the prevailing assumption is that these people are basically trying to say that they're trans species, and in that sense they're trying to, like, advocate for political rights in the way that a transgender person would. Although these communities, like otherkins and Therians, have maintained that that's not the case at all. They say that, like, gender, sexuality, and the animal identity are all separate things. Some of them are actually transgendered. We'll be clear here, like, being transgender is, like, a scientifically proven thing. It has historical precedent. It's also, like, a political identity. Like, it's something that people are advocating for in terms of, like, attaining political rights. It's an extremely scrutinized political identity, one that's very much a threat right now. Otherkins, this is a community and a subculture. I would not say that they are the same thing at all. And again, otherkins themselves are saying that this is not the same thing.
Are otherkins trying to, like, they're not trying to live their lives as these different species, are they?
I think it depends on who is in the community. Like, again, it's, like, many different people. I know that there have probably been, like, these viral videos of, like, some random person being like, I'm trans species and, like, I should get political rights because of that. But, like, I think a lot of other kids are just, like, congregating again in, like, these niche internet spaces. And
but I mean, like, physically, like, are they eating from bowls and, like, walking on all fours?
No, I think it's mostly expressed online. Like, I'm sure, again, there are extremes within the community, yeah. But
it's, like, more, it's like, more like I feel...
an inner identity that they can explore on the internet.
Right.
They also separate themselves from bestiality and zoophilia and say that it's very condemned in these circles. Some scholars refer to otherkin and Therians as socio-spiritual movements. They say that the internet allows for these kinds of, like, neo-pagan, or what they call open source belief systems, to come about. Like, there are like these internal rules and rituals and traditions and like self-contained belief systems that go into it. But a lot of people in this community have argued against that also, because they say that Otherkin and Therianthropy aren't organized in the way religions would be. One scholar named Venetia Laura Delano Robertson, so many names, has this quote where she says, "Though it is not religious in the traditional sense, Therianthropy is an eclectic ontological position system that draws upon myth, magic, and both mainstream and subcultural media to reify a self that is other than human. As animal humans, Therianthropes are living contradictions. Their identity is fragmented and liminal, but this is exactly the point. The constant renegotiation of the animal-human binary can be seen as synecdochic with other dualities, nature and civilization, physical and spiritual, the self and the cosmos, or Pan versus Zeus." I thought this was really interesting, and I just wanted to end the episode by kind of picking your brain about why you think the internet is such a hotbed for anthropomorphism and like its subcultures and spiritual groups. Like, there are just so many different kinds of groups that incorporate animals into their identities online. And I just want to know why? Why do you think that is?
Well, I think it's perhaps that these people before the internet wouldn't really have a way to know that that was something that they were interested in, or to find like-minded community online. And so, one, obviously, it's just like the internet provides that opportunity to learn about these things, discover things about yourself, and then discover people who share that. But then also, it's again like going back to the idea that the internet allows you to experiment with these identities, to present yourself in different ways. I mean, it sounds like it could be costly, or like at least time consuming, to participate in furrydom in real life when you're building costumes and when you're, you know, trying to actually materialize this interest. But, you know, anybody can join a chat room and sort of take on these identities, or design, like, I don't know, an avatar or something that expresses it. So it just makes sense. I think people have been talking about the internet as a tool for like post-humanism forever, and like the ability to transcend the human body. And so this would just be one sort of way that that manifests, I suppose. And I think it's more interesting than like thinking about post-humanism as like human meets technology, whatever, like cyborg shit. I think it's way cooler to see nerds build animal costumes and make friends.
This whole time during my research, I was just thinking nonstop about post-humanism. For those of you who aren't familiar with it, this is like a really crude oversimplification, but essentially it's the idea that being human is no longer the defining feature of who we are. We've like moved past the human as like the singular central subject and incorporated other forms and identities as well. The human is basically no longer a separate entity from animal or technology. And the more that technology advances, it becomes more integrated into what we call human. So think about like medical advancements, someone having a replacement hip, for example, that hip is not human. It's the idea that like identity is elastic and flexible, it's not rigid. If you're interested in it, Donna Haraway's Cyborg Manifesto, it's really difficult to read, but it's a great piece of text about the movement. I think you saying it's post-humanism is exactly right. Like, I think with furries and other animal-associated subcultures, the internet is this, like, necessity, like I said. And I think it becomes this, like, appendage for a facet of these people's identities by virtue of that. And the animal, or, like, fursona, is this kind of identity that's largely realized on the internet. If it's through, like, the circulation of, like, a digital drawing, or if it's through someone adopting that identity in a chat room. So by doing so, they're kind of breaking down the primacy of the human. They're transcending the human body, like you said. Like, one girl in this one interview I was reading describes furries as preferring to work with computers to people. And then there's this one other kin who was interviewed by Vice, who has this really interesting quote where they say, "My pagan beliefs and worldview is definitely tied up in my other kin identity. I believe our reality can be described using Plato's allegory of the cave. We are prisoners of our own flesh, and our ability to perceive reality is flawed and incomplete because it has to be filtered through our meat." And I just think that's such a cool concept or outlook. I don't know. What do you think of what he was saying there?
No, I mean, this was what I really loved with researching the chat room episode too, is that I think it's interesting to think about someone almost like breaking a piece of themselves, and like the computer is where like a certain facet of them like exists and how that becomes incorporated into someone's identity is really interesting. And like, I don't know. And I, of course, like I have such mixed and complicated feelings about the internet and about computers and about technology. And in so many ways, I'm a Luddite.
A Luddite with an internet podcast.
I know. And that's the irony of my life. But I just think in situations like this, I think there is something really, I don't know, kind of fascinating and wholesome about it. And I think it just takes like a certain kind of brain to sort of even get there in the first place. All I'm saying is, wow, it's so interesting. And that's probably the least interesting response you can have.
No, I think it's a very interesting response because it's a very minority response. I really think like instead of being disgusted by furries or shunning them, I think like as outsiders, it's really important to think about why so many people are drawn to this at this day and age. And I think like the furry as an idea is actually a really useful tool for thinking about where humans are evolving and what kinds of like humanity or non-humanity are born from internet spaces. And I really do think like furries represent a human penchant for like curiosity and creativity and community. Just through researching this, I really came to kind of admire furries. I think, you know, every subculture has its own extremes, but that isn't really a reason to shun or mock the entire community. And ultimately, like, furries and even other kin could actually teach us a lot about ourselves if we just took the time to listen to them. And honestly, if that tweet is true and furries are responsible for operating most of the world's technology, I think it would maybe be in our best interest to be a bit nicer to them.
Our furries ourselves. Do you think that Dr. Seuss would be a furry?
Rehash is hosted by Hannah Rain and me, Maia. It's produced and edited by me, and the intro and outro song is produced by our talented friend, Ian Mills. Thanks for listening.